Chapter 8. Quiet your mind. Create a blank slate. No expectations, no assumptions, no talking. In my system, blank slate is a verb. As negotiators, we actively blank slate in order to create a blank slate in our own minds, which then sits ready and waiting to receive any new information, new attitudes, new emotions, or new anything that our adversary wittingly or unwittingly beams our way. It is through blank slating that we learn what's really going on in this negotiation, what's really holding things up, what the adversary really needs. Blank slate is a key behavioral goal that you'll have to practice over and over and over. For successful negotiations, it must become a habit. And in order to blank slate, you're probably going to have to give up some habits that you may think are beneficial, but are hurting you in more ways than you can imagine. I've already pointed out some of the dangers of neediness. Another danger of neediness of any kind is that it interferes with blank slating. So does the fear of hearing no and the fear of failing. Obviously, the tendency of some of us to know it all interferes with blank slating, because if we know it all, why bother to listen? All of these negative behavioral activities that we've already discussed have to go out the window in the interests of blank slating. But once we do get the hang of blank slate, we become so focused and intense that we almost feel we're stepping out of our bodies, going to a corner of the room and watching ourselves negotiate with the adversary. It's an exhilarating feeling. Your ability to blank slate is directly related to your ability to rid yourself of expectations and assumptions, two very bad words in my system of negotiation, real taboos. By nature, we humans are chock full of expectations and assumptions. As a negotiator, you must learn to recognize them and set them aside. They have less than zero value to you as a serious negotiator. Your positive expectations are killers. How many times have you heard one of these statements from your adversary? It looks good. That's exactly what we need. No question, this is superior. Let's get together and wrap this up. Boy, you're just in time. Do we need you? Do you think you can deliver 5,000 by next month? Well, this isn't set in concrete. You folks are right on target. This is in the groove. Fits right in with where we're trying to go. With such remarks, and they are infinite in variety, any business person with much experience could rattle dozens off the top of his head, your adversary is building your positive expectations to close the deal. If you buy into these statements, he'll move right in and take the advantage. It looks good. When the novice on the other side of the table hears such a statement, he starts mentally counting coups, and then gets whipsawed by the next statement. What's going to be your discounted price? The novice provides some number, and there he is, locked in for the rest of the negotiation, unless he's really good. And he's not really good, or he wouldn't have talked price at such an early stage in the negotiation, before he knew anything at all. Happens all the time. In a recent negotiation I coached, the other team said they needed our best price on 33,000 units. Everyone at the table knew that the going price for this expensive widget was somewhere around $1,000 per. The adversary told my client that although they had other suppliers for this item, they really wanted to give us the whole order so that they could get the best price. What happens when a negotiator is given the scent of such an order? If we're not careful, the first thing that pops into our mind is the number 33 million. Even with a volume discount thrown in, even for a large multinational, this counts as real money. As new business, it would be a triumph for any negotiator. If we're not careful, the blank slate has just been wiped away by this positive expectation. And that's exactly what the other team was trying to do in this case, build our expectations. Now, say we are suckered in by our excitement and immediately give them our best discounted price for the 33,000 units, expecting them to jump on this number, sign the contract this afternoon, and open the champagne tonight. And say they don't jump, and they won't, because the champagne can wait, and they've played this game a million times. Instead, they come back and announce that they've decided to spread the purchase of these units among several vendors after all. Moreover, they've miscalculated their inventory, Turns out they only need 10,000 new units, not 33,000. And they want us to supply only 3,000 of these, at the same incredibly good unit price we just agreed to for an order 10 times as large. And by the way, they hint broadly, they're going to be very disappointed if we don't give them that price, if we say no. Now what do we do? Now what are our emotions? Now what good did all those positive expectations do us? If there is one classic maneuver played by large multinationals and shrewd dealers in all fields to take advantage of anxious adversaries, this is the one. Build positive expectations with pie-in-the-sky numbers, then start in with the ifs, ands, and buts. A specific case in point regarding expectations dates from a few years back when I coached a small $8 million company in its negotiation with a very large Irish firm. My team of four negotiators traveled to Ireland for a meeting, a $20,000 total expense probably, not inconsiderable for this small company. When they arrived, the Irish folks were suddenly unavailable. Pure gamesmanship? Perhaps. In any event, many negotiators would have let the prospect of this meeting drive up their positive expectations, and confronted with this disappointment, have started thinking in terms of, well, we're here, and we don't want to waste this trip. Then, who knows what decisions they would have made. But my team had blank slated. They had not flown over with high expectations, so had no qualms about saying, in effect, hey, it doesn't matter. They turned right around and flew home the following day. A few days later, they calmly wrote a letter expressing their understanding that emergencies do happen, setting forth a new agenda and inviting the Irish team to fly over here for the next meeting, which they did. But positive expectations are so positive. They feel so good. Who doesn't want to be hopeful? I had one client who had an especially hard time ridding himself of positive expectations. For one thing, he had played tennis in high school and college, and every coach he had along the way extolled the virtues of a positive attitude. Positive attitude sounds great, but to me it's just another more seductive way of saying positive expectations. For the negotiator, even a positive attitude is dangerous. Yes, it's true. It can devolve quickly into neediness, into positive expectations. When I teach blank slate, I mean blank slate. And it's hard. Your negative expectations are also killers. What about negative expectations? What about the string of double bogeys or double faults or the series of lost deals? What happens to the emotional state of individuals stuck in these ruts? If they're not very careful, they become rattled and emotional. Very likely, initial positive expectations now give way to negative expectations, which can have a terribly debilitating effect. The dreaded S-word, slump, comes to mind. Surely, negative expectations play some role when we go into a slump, and negotiators, certainly those in direct sales, do have slumps. In negotiations, your adversary may try to draw you into positive expectations, as we've seen, or they may try to draw you into negative expectations before things even get started. Consider this deal. A large contractor wants to buy a piece of equipment that usually sells for $1.7 million. Since they sometimes subcontract the work with a company that buys large numbers of these machines, they know that the discounted price for large orders is $1.3 million per unit. Now, they want the same discounted price for their purchase of just one unit, and they stipulate this at the very beginning of negotiations. The untrained negotiator will hear this stipulation and immediately have a negative expectation of either no deal at all or a deal so heavily discounted that it might as well be no deal at all. The trained negotiator, meanwhile, has no thoughts either way about the final price for the machine. The trained negotiator recognizes those early numbers for what they are, early numbers of no real significance. The trained negotiator knows that there's nothing in his mission and purpose about busting the rate sheet just because this company wants him to. And he says, "Gee, we're sorry, we just can't sell the one machine to anyone, even you folks with whom we'd love to do business, for $1.3 million. Maybe you could try to buy a used machine from your friends with the other company, or get them to order an extra machine in their next order, and then you could buy it from them. That might take some time, but wouldn't that work for you?" This negotiator has blank-slated and nurtured. and now waits for the reply. Perhaps the most pervasive, straightforward example of negative expectations is when you're dealing with someone or with an entire company that has always been difficult to work with, badgered you to death, more trouble than they were worth. This is what you feel after every negotiation with these adversaries. Well, maybe they are more trouble than they're worth, and if they are, you make that decision and cut your losses. But you do so calmly and rationally, not because these people are a pain in the ass. Tomorrow, they may not be a pain in the ass, for whatever reason. Remember from Chapter 5, my client in San Francisco who paid a visit to the diabetic guy once a month for 2 years? He had every reason to develop negative expectations. If the visit hadn't been so convenient and easy, he probably would have said goodbye for good. But keeping in touch was no trouble, and he didn't succumb to negative expectations, and eventually he concluded that negotiation to everyone's satisfaction. However, my client's grade could be marked down for failing to find out exactly why this guy acted like he did in the morning. If he had blank-slated, he could have saved some time off those 2 years of waiting. Neither positive nor negative expectations have a place in my system. When you blank-slate and you negotiate, that's all. When you have a mission and purpose in place, when you have behavioral goals in place, when you've established your plan to solve the real problem, when you have laser-like focus, when you have all this going for you, why would you want to climb on any kind of emotional roller coaster of expectations? Once you really start using my system, you're so dedicated to goals over which you have control, so oblivious to anything over which you don't have control, and so free of neediness that expectations shouldn't even enter into the equation. But, of course, they do anyway. Expectations are everywhere, and in this regard, they're like emotions. In fact, they are emotions. You cannot banish them once and for all, but you can see them for what they are and take appropriate measures. When things seem to be going your way in a negotiation, it's easy to get excited and tempting to let your emotions take over. When you feel this happening, call a timeout. Take a bathroom break or suggest a break for coffee or for lunch or step back in some other way. Oh, come on, I've had students say, blank slating can't be that big a deal. They sense the discipline required, and this scares them a little, and it should. Discipline is difficult, but without discipline, you'll never be a great negotiator, and you'll leave money on the table time after time. Assume nothing. Now, what about assumptions, the other chief obstacle to effective blank slating? They're just as dangerous as positive and negative expectations, and just as common, because most of us come to believe that we're pretty good at reading other people, at understanding what they're really feeling and thinking. Negotiators in particular tend to pride themselves on their people skills. 1,000 times I've heard someone say, "I know what they'll do if we make that offer." This is the way they operate. If you raise the price, they'll want a volume discount. "I'm pretty sure she makes the decisions over there." "There's no way they'll make an offer today." There are just a million assumptions out there, lying in wait to ambush us. I learned my first lesson on the subject growing up in western Pennsylvania, where hunting was a way of life for a boy. When I got my first shotgun, a 410 bought by Cousin Earl from the Sears catalog, I turned it over carefully in my hands. I can still vividly picture the scene. Many readers probably have the same memory. And I remember my father's first words to me: "Check and see if it's loaded. Never assume a gun is not loaded. Always check for yourself." We're all vulnerable to assumptions, despite the fact that we can all identify ones that have been flat-out wrong. In Kosovo, NATO thought Slobodan Milosevic would cave in after a few high-altitude bombing sorties against isolated army barracks, while Milosevic thought that NATO politics would limit the alliance to these same few high-altitude bombing sorties against isolated army barracks. Results of these assumptions, delusions might be the better word in this context, were tragic. In the Vietnam War, our leaders assumed that if we stopped bombing during the Christmas holidays, Ho Chi Minh would draw back as well. This incorrect assumption cost about 3,000 lives in 1 week. Back at the turn of the century, village blacksmiths who were married to the horse and buggy assumed they were in a lot of trouble, but other blacksmiths saw nothing but opportunity from the newfangled automobiles, opportunity in the form of service stations and repair bills. They were able and willing to see things new, to see things as they now were, to blank slate, and thereby to seize opportunity. In 1982, air traffic controllers assumed that President Reagan wouldn't have the guts to lock them out. Ouch! The baseball umpires, as mentioned in Chapter 4, assumed that the often incompetent Major League bureaucracy wouldn't have the guts to accept their resignations. Ouch! In Chapter 3, I mentioned Bill Gates's brilliant decision to acknowledge that he and Microsoft had been wrong to ignore the Internet. But what had happened there in the first place? A failure to blank slate. Plain and simple. Coming from a software background, Bill Gates and his minions had failed to see that the net could be bigger than the PC operating system, perhaps even make it obsolete eventually. Close call, Bill. Maybe the favorite of all my stories among the folks who take one of my workshops concerns one Samuel Langley, who knew everything about the steam engine back at the turn of the 20th century. He knew that steam was the ultimate power source for the foreseeable future. He just knew it. Therefore, he tried to power an airplane with a steam engine. Langley was laughably wrong in retrospect, but he went on to become a critical inventor in the world of aviation. How? By doing a lot of things we've talked about in previous chapters. He was able to hear the world say no to him in the form of failed experiments. He was able to embrace failure. He was able to set activity goals he could manage, not ends he could not control, such as powering an airplane with a steam engine. And he was able to blank slate and start all over. And he was able to blank slate and start all over. When the solution to powered flight proved to be the gasoline engine, not the steam engine, Langley embraced the new knowledge. If he'd continued along the dead-end road that was his steam engine, he would never have contributed to aviation. And Langley Air Force Base in Virginia would now be named for someone else. And now, a final story that's also well-received in my workshops, but without pleasure. In the 1960s, experts who knew everything about rockets and missiles were absolutely positive that aerial combat in the future would only be fought from a great distance. Close-in dogfighting was ancient history. Airplanes would fly at supersonic speeds, radar would see the enemy, missiles would be launched from many miles away, and battles would be won and lost by pilots who never saw the enemy planes. The engineers and experts were so certain this was correct that they built the first fighter aircraft in the history of aerial combat that was not equipped with a machine gun or rapid-firing cannon. That was the F-4 Phantom. Guess what? Over North Vietnam, the lighter Soviet MiGs got in close where the American missiles weren't effective and sometimes shot down the bigger, less maneuverable, and gunless F-4. The horrible mistaken assumption surfaced quickly, and the vision of the solution was all too clear. But it took 9 months to retroarm the F-4s with a simple gun. The so-called experts just didn't know what they didn't know. They were incapable of blank slating. A tragic mistake for many of America's finest young men. Back to business. How many times have you made the steam engine mistake and failed to correct your error? How many times have you gone into a meeting for one reason only to find out that you were there for a completely different reason? How many times have you looked at the way someone was dressed and made an assumption, good or bad, that you later discovered was completely wrong? When was the last time you made an assumption based on the car someone was driving? We're talking Columbo here, of course. You never want to make the mistake that his suspects make, underestimating him. Anyone with much experience in business can recall when they didn't even bother calling on a potential client or supplier or customer because they assumed this deal would never work out, only to learn later that it might well have worked out. We've all done that, except perhaps Stanley Marcus, who preached to his sales force to treat every customer as if he or she were a millionaire, because he or she might indeed be a millionaire. Certainly so in oil-rich Texas. Actually, assumptions are perhaps even more dangerous than expectations, because they're so subtle and insidious. If I say the word retirement, what do I mean? If I say, I'll pay you $2, what would you think? If I say, I'm too busy to do this, what do you do? Every day such statements are made, and every day we make assumptions when we hear them. Retirement? The word can mean a million things. You don't know what I mean until you ask questions. Interrogative-led questions, such as, why do you want to retire? If you accepted my $2 without question, you made an assumption that I wouldn't pay more than $2, and I never said I wouldn't. If you believed me when I said I was too busy, you assumed that I was telling the truth, and you assumed you knew what I meant by the word. But what does busy mean to me? Could we have different definitions? Of course we could. You have to find out. Now, let's play another workshop game. Close your eyes and picture a horse. Okay, what color is the horse? Is it light or dark? Shiny or dull? How big is the horse? How tall? How wide is he across the back? Oops! Did you recognize when I made my first assumption? Sure you did if you pictured a mare and I said he. Because I pictured he when I posed the situation, that's when I blew the blank slate. In a real negotiation, that mistake could put me in a losing position. If you were in the horse business and were looking for a filly and I was picturing a gelding, we're not off to a good start. I needed to see your picture of the horse, not my picture. Forget my picture. Doesn't matter at all. But all too often, we make this very mistake. Any one of us could sit down in the evening for 10 minutes and make a list of the assumptions we made that day. Assumptions are like expectations, in that we can't get rid of them. But as good negotiators, we can be aware of them. We can also plant assumptions. And if the opposing parties let you, why not? Say you're asked how much your widget costs. It's expensive, you say. Well, this word means very different things to a millionaire and to a man making $30,000. And here's the important kicker. Each immediately assumes that you mean what he means, and you may well find him preparing to pay a price much higher than yours. In fact, people, negotiators, make offers higher than you ever dreamed they would because of such false assumptions on their part. When can this be done? Soon? Well, soon can mean anything. When you're told soon, you have to find out. Ask a question. When you say soon, you can take advantage of the fact that your adversaries don't find out. Our assumptions always work against us. Their assumptions can work for us. Do your research. Research can rid us of many assumptions and help us blank slate, but we don't have the habit of doing research. Instead, we allow ourselves to be led by assumptions. The lack of information makes it easy to assume and almost impossible to blank slate. Not knowing about something, you have the urge to fill in the blanks with the first thing that pops into your mind. You wing it, so to speak. But not the Japanese. Before they go into any negotiation, they do in-depth research, sending out teams to study and gather facts about the companies and the markets involved. But we Americans often skip this vital step. I am constantly amazed at how many negotiations are concluded without even the most basic research, going to the web, to the business papers and magazines, to the financial statements and year-end reports, in order to study the adversary and find out its financial position, its strengths and weaknesses in the marketplace, its major profit or loss centers. A client in Silicon Valley mentioned the other day that he's constantly amazed at how his negotiating team out-prepares teams from Fortune 100 companies. Fortune 100, not 500. The biggest and therefore presumably among the best companies we have to offer. On the other hand, the supply systems management teams from aggressive multinationals will have done copious research. You can pretty much assume that they know every competitor for your product or service, and the financial condition of those competitors, their strengths and weaknesses, their negotiating strategy, their negotiating success, the decision-making hierarchy, and personal details about the key decision-makers, education, college, awards, family, pets, golf handicap, and so on. It follows that you must have the same information about your adversary and your competitors, doesn't it? There's just no excuse in failing to learn all you can about everything relating to your field of business in general, and this negotiation in particular. But if you enter a negotiation with a win-win frame of mind, Are you going to feel the necessity all that strongly? I doubt it. And we now have even less excuse for failing to do research than we used to. 20 years ago, the library was a few blocks away. What a chore. Today, the web is right in front of us, on our desks. Use it. That said, the low-tech newspaper remains an invaluable resource. Did you know that the North Vietnamese used a network of Americans to gather harmless news releases on local young men during the Vietnam War? They stockpiled this information in case some of these men became their prisoners of war. And some of them did. And some of them were broken with the help of this information about family and home. A horrible example of the power of applied research. A much more pleasant example is provided by Coach Woody Hayes of Ohio State, whom I had the privilege of knowing in the 1960s and 70s. Coach Hayes was one of the greatest football coaches who ever lived, but that's secondary. He was also one of the greatest individuals of his era. He had an enormous impact on my life, as he had on the lives of thousands of others. He had an enormous impact on my ideas for negotiation. Coach Hayes was an indefatigable reader of newspapers. Today, he'd be a master of the web universe, without a doubt. He used his research to impress, persuade, educate, and demonstrate that being a great coach required more than just winning football games. At the 100-year commemoration of the death of Ralph Waldo Emerson, Harvard University chose Coach Hayes, yes, Woody Hayes, the college football coach, to be the keynote speaker, at which time he used his vast stores of research to compare the lessons of Emerson to our modern-day problems. He received a standing ovation. Now, let's recall that negotiation from earlier in this chapter, the one in which the adversary wants the same volume discount for 3,000 widgets that our company usually gives for much larger orders. Mentioning the number 33,000 early in the negotiation was intended to drive up my client's positive expectations, and against many negotiators, this time-tested trick might have worked. But my team had done its research. It knew that the multinational's total worldwide capacity for these widgets was only 22,000 units. The nerve! Those negotiators never intended to procure 33,000 widgets. They were only interested in driving up expectations and thereby extracting a price they could then use for leverage. Thanks to research, thanks to blank slating, this gambit didn't work with my clients. They knew there wasn't going to be an order for 33,000 units, so they hadn't gotten excited. They said instead, "No, sorry, we can't help you with those 3,000 widgets at such a steep discount." It couldn't be simpler. Research is indispensable, but the best, single, easy-to-use, foolproof tool we have at our disposal to blank slate is the simplest one imaginable: taking great notes. By its very nature, if we stop to think about the process, note-taking removes us from our world and keeps us in our adversary's world. The simple act of picking up the pen or pencil moves us in that direction. Note-taking reinforces listening skills. As we take our notes, our concentration is automatically focused on what's being said. In seminars, meetings, and negotiations, I can quickly tell which ones are the most successful people around the table. They're effectively silencing their own thoughts and learning as much as they can about their adversary's world. They're the ones listening closely and taking notes. They are blank slating and gathering the pieces of the puzzle. It's important to note that they are not solving the puzzle. That comes later with analysis, with burning the midnight oil. They know what is really said, and what we actually hear during a negotiation is far more important than what we allow ourselves to think while others talk. In order to blank slate effectively, the little voice in our own heads must be silent. If we take notes, we have to be listening. We all think we're good listeners, but when was the last time you focused on your listening skills just for practice? You must listen to every word just as closely as a trial lawyer listens to every word of testimony, without letting the mind wander off, without thinking about what you want to say next, without interrupting, without answering your own questions. I'm not much of a Freudian, but Freud did preach to his pupils that they must adopt the same approach with their patients. First, just listen with the most open possible mind. Don't judge. That comes later. As we take our notes, our emotions are more easily controlled. Our nerves relax. Our stomach quiets down. We comfortably settle into the negotiating session. We don't show excitement or disappointment. As we take notes, we're also allowing the adversary to be more okay by making her feel more important because we're taking notes on what she has to say. And then, on the plain practical side, notes are our documentation of what was said and also what was done or gestured, because great note-takers make note of nonverbal behavior and moods. How many times have you found yourself unable to remember a point? You might have gotten the gist of it, but can't remember the specifics. You're left with some holes in the conversation, perhaps even a general vagueness. Worse yet, when was the last time you found yourself wondering who you just talked to because you hadn't written down someone's name? Was it Sue or Sally? Jim or John? Most people can scribble down a few notes here and there in a conversation, but taking great notes takes a lot of practice. The next meeting you go to, pull out your legal pad instead of your business card. Next time the phone rings, pick up your pen, really listen, and take notes, even if it's your mother on the line. That might be the ultimate challenge, trying to blank slate with a close member of your family. If we take notes, we're listening, which is good, and we're not talking, which is equally good. No talking. This is one of my cardinal rules, and an exaggeration, as I admitted earlier. I don't mean that you can't utter a word, but I do mean that in a negotiation, most of us should talk a lot less than we do, in the interest of controlling neediness, in the interest of blank slating. When we're spare with our words, we're able to ask much more focused questions, which keep us on track and give us clearer pictures. If you can't keep from talking, you won't be able to blank slate. Not talking is hard. We're trained through education to know all the answers and to blurt them out at the first opportunity. We've been rewarded time and time again for knowing the correct answer. Our life has revolved around our intelligence. We go to great pains to let people know what we know, but the danger here is easily illustrated. We've all been to social functions where someone seems to know it all, and he makes the ridiculous assumption that people enjoy hearing him unload his vast stores of knowledge. But what really happens when you find yourself trapped in that situation with that guy? For one thing, you may feel un-okay and get a little defensive and resentful and turn him off entirely. How seriously do you take him? How much do you remember of what he said? Talk about a bad assumption. His assumption that you'll be impressed by all his talking literally takes him out of the game. Here's another assumption, on my part this time. This blowhard, gasbag know-it-all will be a man. Funny about that. Spilling the beans. So, no talking, or less talking. As a negotiator, if you can't control the motor mouth, you're eventually going to say something you'll regret for the duration of that negotiation. Communication by email is often preferred to a phone call, especially for a beginning negotiator, because it reduces emotion. It also reduces the possibility of spilling your beans in the lobby. That's the phrase I use for the mistaken revelation of information, spilling the beans. When it happens the next time, just make sure it's from the other side, not from you. If you conduct many negotiations, you will be the happy recipient of spilled beans. That's because many people knowingly spill beans as they fight for the feeling of self-importance. Kind of pitiful, but true. People also spill beans in the very mistaken belief that this will help advance their own position or agenda, like in The Godfather's Part 2, when poor, weak Fredo spills to Hyman Roth, by way of Johnny Ola, details about Michael Corleone's position in the negotiation, all because Ola assured Fredo there'd be something in it for him if the negotiations were successfully concluded. Beans get spilled all over the place, that's the truth, and your job is to gather up all those beans and put them to good use. As it happens, I have something of a pet peeve regarding spilled beans in a very specific situation. Putting forth a full financial package for a highest-level corporate officer before getting a commitment from the candidate to accept or reject that package. Often, officers looking for a new colleague feel they have to offer the package before asking for the commitment. They feel the package drives the negotiation. But what happens is that the candidate takes the spilled beans, the financial package offer, back to his current employer and uses it for leverage. Happens all the time. I urge a different approach. I urge my clients to say to the candidate, "We're going to commit to a financial package that will be at the top of the industry, but we're not going to reveal it until we have your commitment to take it or reject it. We don't want this package to be used to start a bidding war with your current company." Now, this is a fair approach, but companies are afraid they'll lose the candidate, so they spill the beans. And then they lose the candidate because they spilled the beans when he uses the package for leverage and re-ups with his current company. Often, people blatantly tell you they're about to spill vital beans. I shouldn't really say this since I work for Intrepid, but I agree with your company's reaction. Our side has made some really dramatic statements, but this is all about negotiation. We pay penalties when we're late, and we expect our suppliers to share part of that if they're late for us. We don't really plan to sue you into the ground if you're late, but we have to start the agreement somewhere. Richard would not want to hear me talking to you, but we're looking for you to have some cash in the game. Doesn't have to be 10%. We pulled that number out of the air. What's the first rule in negotiating? Always ask for more than what you're willing to take. So we did, but it doesn't have to be 10%. I don't know what it has to be. Could be software, spares, service, a credit toward other products. I don't know. We just want to make sure you're committed to executing. Tom would probably kill me for saying this, but the truth is that he loves your product. The technology will solve all of our needs today. Period. That's a fact. In the dance company negotiation I've followed off and on since Chapter 3, one of the program director's 30-minute monologues with the booking agent divulged that one of the agent's colleagues had advised the director that her organization was not the only one that had not signed a contract. What a situation. The director was spilling the beans about spilled beans, and the information about the original beans was wrong to boot. I have to admit that I'd be very surprised, flabbergasted, if any client of mine committed the same error. It's just so foolish. But Lord knows they have ample opportunity. I've mentioned the cozy relationships that many corporate negotiators try to establish with their adversaries for the sake of establishing a subtle neediness on the adversary's part. Another purpose of these close relationships is the opportunity they pose for collecting spilled beans. "Say, Joe, is that pricing structure you guys just proposed for real?" Or maybe it's some remark that's just a little leading. "Boy, Joe, that's a bear of a position you guys took last week." In the hope that you, by way of friendship, might slip and reply, "Well, you know how the game's played, Pete." We've seen how negotiators use hints of huge purchases, future global alliances and the like, to set up naive win-win negotiators with neediness and false expectations. But another point of these promises is to get you to spill your beans about internal cost-profit structures. This is basic cost optimization strategy. "Hey, we're partners. Let us help you hold your costs down." It's tough to let go of expectations, not to assume, to listen instead of talking, to take copious notes all the time, to be certain not to spill the beans. But with training and practice, blank slate can become a behavioral goal and discipline for anyone. There's definitely no excuse for the careful negotiators spilling the beans. With dedication and practice, you can make sure that your slate is erasable and easily adjusted. You'll develop the habit of constantly reviewing the status of the negotiation. When your picture changes, you'll change with it. But even if you're good at blank slating, have no expectations and no assumptions, listen well, take great notes, refrain from excessive talking, and don't spill beans, even if you're the perfect blank slater, the world outside the negotiation can still intrude on your ability to blank slate. If you're overly tired, it's difficult to focus. If you're dealing with the remains of the night before, blank slating is difficult. If there's a crisis in your home, blank slating can be impossible. If you feel you cannot blank slate for any reason, you have only one option. Cancel the negotiating session. This is how important the blank slate is. Play a mind game. When you were a small child, did you ever see a pony in the clouds, or perhaps the face of a clown? When you read Robin Hood, did you literally see Friar Tuck fall in the river? Did you see yourself shoot the arrow that won the archery contest? It's this ability to envision that we had as children that we must now cultivate as negotiators. When we blank slate, we can truly see, as if for the first time. Through my work with hundreds of students and in hundreds of actual negotiations over the last many years, I've learned that the ability to envision varies with individuals. I also know that the ability to envision is directly linked to the level of success we can achieve. The greater the ability to envision, the greater the potential for success. If you can't see it, you'll never be able to do it. Everyone can see better than they do now. There are many simple exercises that help us do so. Consider the word sky. Say it to yourself. Close your eyes. See the sky you want to see. All of us have a favorite sky. Pick another word for a phenomenon in the natural world. See that phenomenon. Turn it around in your mind's eye. When you get the chance, but sometime soon, go to the movies without leaving your favorite chair. Find a quiet place and relax. Close your eyes and run a movie in your mind of some pleasant time in your life, a sporting event, a date, a fun time in school or at work. Before a negotiation, see that negotiation unfolding in your mind. Picture yourself asking the questions, taking the notes, and negotiating with perfect behavior. See yourself relaxed with no expectations, no need, and no fear. A perfectly blank slate. It works, even for a hard-nosed corporate negotiator.